right, everybody. Let's go to Hosea, if you would. Turn to the book of Hosea. We are studying. Last time we talked about the theme. The theme of this, well, it's up here on behind me here on the board. The theme is spiritual adultery, and specifically looking at it from the Old Testament book of Hosea, though we'll look at other places too. So we looked at the introduction. We went into it a little bit last time, the idea that human marriage is the union of one flesh, and that all throughout the Bible, well, let's stick to the Old Testament first. All throughout the Old Testament, God gives us the picture of God as the bridegroom and as his people as his bride. And when the children of Israel go away from God, then they're committing adultery. They're committing spiritual adultery. Or the word adultery is the word in the Old Testament is harlotry or whoredom, right? Harlotry or whoredom is the word that was used. So the idea is Israel plays the harlot. We saw that in a bunch of different places. And Israel is in a marriage covenant with the Lord. Now, again, we saw last time it's different from today's conception of God. That God loves everyone and God would never judge. Well, you haven't read the Old Testament much and learned about the judgment of God. You can't have God's grace without his judgment. You can't have his love without his hatred of sin and evil, right? So let's look at chapter 1 in Hosea, verse number 1, and let's look at the history. I'm right here. The history and the state of Israel to this point. To get us to the point of the times of Hosea, chapter 1, verse number 1, the word of the Lord that came unto Hosea, the son of, there's all these names, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah in the days of Jeroboam, and the son of Joash, king of Israel. To this point, Israel, remember, let's go all the way back to their beginnings. Well, let's not. Let's go back to Egypt. So Israel came out of Egypt. They wandered in the wilderness for how many years? 40 years they wandered in the wilderness. Then they entered the promised land, the book of Joshua, and they fought for the promised land of Canaan. How did that go, by the way? Well, at first it didn't go. They never, ever drove all of the inhabitants out of the land like they were supposed to. And, of course, that in the book of Joshua, that's a main theme. And the idea of separation is important in the book of Joshua because that's what brought Israel's downfall, that they did not separate. They didn't drive them out like they were supposed to, and then they didn't separate themselves. They had their sons and their daughters intermarry with the surrounding heathen tribes and nations. And so they were led by Joshua, and then the book of Judges, they were led by various judges, right, who came on the scene and usually at a certain geographical area of Israel, not the whole of Israel, but in certain different geographical areas. And certain times God raised up these judges, whether they were Deborah or whether they were Barak or they were Samson or can never say his name. Huh? Jephthah, I think is how you pronounce his name, but don't quote me on that. Anyway, so various judges until the people demanded what? They demanded a king, right? They already had a king, right? They had the best form of government known to man. It's called a theocracy, not a democracy. It's a theocracy, and that's where God controls everything, and God is the one who controls and runs the nation, if you will, and they look to God for the running of their nations, right? So but the people weren't happy with that. They wanted a king like the surrounding nations. So then a monarchy arose. First it was King Saul, and then it was King David, right? And then his son, all right. So we got all that. So we see David, we see Solomon, we see the kingdoms. And then eventually the nation of Israel was split into two different kingdoms, the northern and the southern kingdom, or Israel and Judah, or Judah and Israel, right? Israel in the north and Judah in the south. That's where we are today. That's where we are today. That's where we are in Hosea chapter 1, verse number 1, where it talks about in chapter 1, verse number 1, the kings of Judah, and it mentions Uzziah and Hezekiah and all of those kings, right? Now, the kings of Judah, remember, Israel was split into two. Judah was in the south, and Israel was in the north, all right? And so when it talks about the kings of Judah, it's talking about the south. When it talks about the kings of Israel, it talks about the north, right? Hosea was a prophet in Israel. He was a prophet in the northern kingdom. Remember the northern kingdom? They went into subjection and slavery quicker than the southern kingdom did, right? Because they went into apostasy and rebellion quicker than the southern kingdom did, right? So that's the state of Israel. It's not a very good state. Hosea is a prophet in the worst of the two kingdoms, the northern kingdom, right? So what was the state of Israel at this time, right there, the state of Israel to this point? It was facing dangers within and without. I'll take the without first. The Assyrians were on the rise. They were known for their ruthlessness. The Assyrians were known for their cruelty. And they had been occupied with other foes. But now those foes have been conquered, and now they're ready to turn their attention to Israel. So they have, from without, they have big problems. But it's never from without that a country really goes downhill, is it? It's always from within, like Edward Gibbon wrote many years ago when he wrote the books, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. It's always from within that a civilization crumbles or that a nation crumbles. It's always from within. It's always morally and socially and spiritually that a nation crumbles. It's not just that one other nation comes and conquers them and takes them over, right? So within, there was political turmoil in the nation of Israel. There was danger of revolution. The people had become socially corrupt, morally corrupt, politically corrupt. And some of you may say, it sounds like our day. Well, maybe it sounds like our day. Maybe it is a little bit. Turn to chapter 4 in Hosea. Chapter 4. Chapter number 4. And no president, no man, or no woman, or anyone will ever be able to do anything to stay that, in my opinion. Because I believe, I believe in the covenants of God, but I'm not into covenant theology, but I do believe in dispensations, and I do believe that things are going to get worse and progressively worse as time goes on. Chapter 4, verse number 1. Hear the word of the Lord, ye children of Israel, for the Lord hath a controversy with the inhabitants of the land, because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. Verse 2. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out and blood toucheth blood. So this was a time of great idolatry and also spiritual adultery. It says the land, look what it says in back in chapter number 1. Go back to chapter number 1. Look what it says about the land also at that time, the nation of Israel at that time. Chapter number 1, verse 2. The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea, and the Lord said to Hosea, go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms. In other words, go marry a prostitute, go marry a whore. And children of whoredoms have children with her. For the land, why? For the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. So one thing we see here is that Israel had departed from the Lord, and as far as God was concerned, that's the same thing as committing adultery. He calls it whoredom here. So we see another thing here, that God equates departing from Him with spiritual adultery, or as He says in this verse, whoredom, right? So He equates those two things. I've got a little bit of history here by David Hubbard. He said, in the days of David and Solomon, before the division of the kingdom, Jerusalem was the capital of the land and its temple was the center of worship. After the kingdom split, it was politically infeasible to have the Israelites going down to another kingdom to worship. Jeroboam solved this problem by building rival shrines at Dan in the north and Bethel in the south. In these shrines were the golden calves, which were not at first intended to be idols. They were considered pedestals on which the invisible deity, the Lord of Israel, would enthrone himself. But because the Canaanites worshipped idols, and because one of the characteristic forms of idolatry was a calf, remember the golden calf also? They got that from Egypt. The symbol of the vitality and the fertility god. What started out to be a pedestal for the invisible Lord became a substitute for God, right? So that's kind of what we're talking about when they were committing idolatry. It was a great time of idolatry. Look back again at chapter number 4, if you would. Chapter number 4 in Hosea. I'm kind of flip-flopping back and forth between the two. Flip-flop, that's kind of like what my wife does sometimes. She just kind of goes back and forth on her opinions about stuff and can't nail her down on anything. And if she says one thing and I said, well, you said blah, blah, blah. She said, well, I changed my mind. Okay. Chapter 4, verse number 12. My people ask counsel at their stocks, and their staff declareth unto them. For the spirit of whoredoms hath caused them to err, and they have gone a whoring from under their God. They sacrifice upon the tops of the mountains, which they weren't supposed to do, only in the temple, and burn incense upon the hills, same, under oaks and poplars and elms, because the shadow thereof is good. Therefore, your daughters shall commit whoredom and your spouses shall commit adultery. And I say, Brother Chris, this is supposed to be a nice Sunday school. You shouldn't be using all those words like whoredom. And well, those are Bible words. So if you're not comfortable with them, I'm sorry about that. But anyway, it's a good descriptor. And if God uses it, then I think there's something there. It's a good descriptor of the children of Israel and kind of the state of Israel, like I said up here at the time. Besides idolatry, other pagan practices had taken hold. Drunkenness, temple prostitution, cutting and wailing, weeping in religious pagan ceremonies to appease, you know, they would appease Baal by cutting themselves. Of course, the Catholic Church has kept some of that today, where they the monks and the other, what do you call them, monastery, they live in a monastery. Yeah, that's the female, right, but there's another word I was looking for. But yeah, the monks or the people who live in monasteries, sometimes they beat themselves with cat of nine tails, thinking that that will bring them closer to God. Well, that's a pagan worship, and that's where Israel got it. So anything you can do like cutting or wailing and weeping or in these ceremonies to appease Baal, height, excess emotion, I guess, you know. I don't know if you can compare that to today's charismatic movement, falling on the ground and foaming at the mouth and writhing and stuff like that, or barking like a dog. Holy barking, they call it, I think it is, right? Holy barking. If barking makes you holy, I've got a dog at the house that's probably the most spiritual dog of any dogs that y'all ever know. My dog Susie, she is a good dog. She doesn't bark much at all, is why one of the things I like about her. Anyway, let's go to chapter 7. Where are you at right now? Good. Go forward to chapter 7 then. All right, good. Why are you hanging out at 4? All right. So let's just read this, chapter 7, verse 14, real quick, because we've talked about this topic a few times. And it's a topic that I've been, I don't know, it's just been coming up. People say, Brother Chris, you're talking about this a lot or that. Stuff just comes up and it seems to be repeating. I study stuff and it's like, idolatry is one thing that's been on my mind for the last year or two. But anyway, chapter 7, and I'm not talking about idolatry like you're going to bow down and worship a statue. I'm talking about the idolatry, the idols that we have in our hearts. We put up idols in our hearts. We create idols in our hearts. Anything that takes God's place in your heart is an idol. It doesn't have to be a golden figurine statue of something that you bow down and worship or that you pray to. Although I'm not in favor of doing that, Catholic Church, also not in favor of doing that. But I'm talking about something different that none of us would be guilty of, bowing down and worshiping to a statue. I'm talking about spiritual. But let's look at this. Chapter 7, verse 14. And they have not cried unto me with their heart, when they howled upon their beds, they assembled themselves for corn and wine, and they rebel against me. We said it many times, the problem of idolatry is a human problem. And I've got another verse here I want to look at. Hold on, let me find it real quick. Just make sure I wrote it down. Sometimes I'm not good at writing stuff down. You'd think I would be better. I think I know where it is, if you'll allow me to find it. Verse 14 in chapter 4. Let's go back to chapter 4 and verse 14. Chapter 4, verse 14. I will not punish your daughters when they commit whoredom, nor your spouses when they commit adultery, for themselves are separated with whores, and they sacrifice with harlots. Therefore, the people that doth not understand shall fall. Now, you're like, well, Brother Chris, this is a sensitive word. And, look, it's the Bible. Either you like it or you don't, right? But the word whoredom is there, the word adultery is there, the word whores is there, the word harlots is there. Are you getting the picture yet? I mean, is the picture clear enough or not, right? That's the thing. The problem of idolatry is a human problem in every age. We are created to worship God, and we will worship something. If we reject God, that inside of us, the image of God inside of us that's made that we can't escape. Like, you want to escape your conscience? Good luck. There are some people that are born that with seemingly no conscience, right? They're the outliers. We call them serial killers and we put them behind bars for the rest of their lives, right? But for most people born on this earth, you have a conscience whether you like it or not. Well, guess what? That's because you're made in God's image. Guess what? You also have this idea that you want to worship. And we have this will or this desire to worship. Now, our desire to worship is only fulfilled in our worship of God. You can worship anything you want to. It'll never bring you lasting fulfillment, joy, peace, or happiness, or purpose, or any of those things. Only the worship of God will. You're going to be a slave to someone today. You're going to be a slave to sin and Satan, or you're going to be a slave to God. There's no way around that. There's no way to get around it. There's only two choices. There's not all roads go to heaven or many roads or whatever. So we are created to worship. And if you reject God, that desire you have to worship does not go away. It stays within you. You're going to worship something. Or in the case of religious cults, you're going to worship someone, right? Sometimes I see independent Baptists get a little bit close to that when they worship the pastor, and sometimes that makes me a little nervous. There's a difference between honoring and respecting your pastor and worshiping. Luckily, in this church, we've never had that problem, but I've seen that before, and I'm totally against it because you're going to worship something. And you say, well, I worship the man of God. That's your idol. It's not God, right? People are going to put something in the place of God in their hearts. If they don't want God in their hearts, they don't want anything to do with Him, that's fine. But you're going to put something there at the center of your lives. And everything in your life pivots around it. It's why you get up in the morning. It's why you go to work. It's why you do what you do. It's why you I'm doing this for my family. That's fine. But if that takes the place of God, then your family is your idol. Your family is your idol. Well, I go to work every day so I can feed my family. That's good. So did I. I still do it, right? I've done it for 40, 50 years now. That's fine. I have no problem with that. But if that's the center of your life, then that's your idol. Your family is your idol, and it replaces God, and it's blasphemous. What can I say? But everyone does it. Everyone puts something in the center of their lives. What gets you out of... I know I'm going off on the subject. I told you I've been reading this a lot. What gets you up out of bed in the morning? What makes you think when you open your eyes, this is why I'm here, this is what I want to do today, right? Is it you drag yourself out of bed, oh, another day, man, I got to go to the, man, stupid work. I'm the smartest person there, they just don't recognize it, right? Now, the only person that can maybe say that in this audience would be Jonathan, but other than that, but he works with some smart dudes, so, I don't know if he's the smartest one or whatever, but anyway. What gets you out of bed? What motivates you, right? What do you think about when you're driving down the road and you're not thinking about that idiot that just cut you off? Instead, you're trying to be godly, your mind is blank. What do you think about when your mind is blank? That's what you love. What you love, you think about it all the time. Am I right? Right? Sometimes I think about, man, I would really like one of those Bibles. Those look awesome. Man, it's all red. Oh, whoa. And it's got red gilding. Oh, my. Well, I didn't think about it. I did it. But anyway, but that's the point. What do you think about when your mind is blank? Well, that is an indicator. I'm not saying that's totally. But that's an indicator that may be what you love. Why do you get out of bed in the morning? That's the idea. If it isn't God, it's idolatry. The good news is Hosea shows us, back to the subject, Hosea shows us that no matter how dark the situation might be, like we just saw, the situation with Israel was pretty dark, y'all. Could he have made it any plainer in verse 14 when he uses the word whoredom or whore three or four times and adultery once? Could it be any plainer? What the situation of Israel, how dark it was in Israel at the time. Don't worry, they're fixing to get taken over. God's going to send them into judgment, and that's it for them. But for now, things are really, really dark. But no matter how dark the situation, the good news is God is sovereign over all of our circumstances. God is God even in the darkness. God is God no matter what our circumstances or situations are. And if you'll put God on the throne of your heart, so to speak, then that's where, in those circumstances, situations, God can give you help. He can give you guidance. He can give you joy in the midst of circumstances. He can give you peace and speak peace to you in the midst of... But anyway, the good news is we're going to see in Hosea, God is sovereign over all these circumstances. Didn't we see that with Jonah? Wasn't God sovereign over the wind and the waves? Wasn't God sovereign over the whale? And he told that whale, hey, go swallow that guy over there. And what do you think the whale thought? Huh? First of all, you know, no, I'm not going to. Anyway, right. But God is sovereign over circumstances, and we as Christians need to remember that. The man I just quoted, Hubbard, wrote this. He wrote, "God is neither deaf nor lacking in strength. As we look to God, what appears to be our darkest hour may prove to be our finest." So let's go back to Hosea chapter 1. I like that. What appears to be our darkest hour may prove to be our finest. And of course, all of us who are of a certain age anyway are reminded of Winston Churchill's speech during World War II about that kind of subject, right? Right, he's talking about that this is Britain's darkest hour, but we're not going to surrender. We'll fight them in the landings. We'll fight them on, you know, all that, right? Anyway, Hosea chapter 1. It's an inspiring speech if you've never listened to it. Hosea chapter 1, look at verse number 2. The beginning of the word, we read it once, of the Lord by Hosea. And the Lord said unto Hosea, what's the Lord going to tell his prophet, his chosen man to be his mouthpiece? What is he going to tell him? Go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom departing from the Lord. Now, few books in the Bible start with as thought-provoking a passage as this, where God declares, well, first, let's go to the end of that verse, where God declares Israel, it says there, the land hath committed great whoredom departing from the Lord. Israel had become like a spiritual brothel, guilty of harlotry. Why? Because they had gone after other gods. They had gone after other gods. They had stopped being faithful to the one true God. Do you see that through the history of Israel? We saw that last week, right? Remember when the children of Israel were brought up out of Egypt, right? And they came to the mount, right? And then Moses goes up to the mount and he stays up there for at least 30 some odd days. And then the children of Israel are like, well, he ain't never coming back. What do we do? I know, Aaron, make us some golden stuff so that we can worship it, right? And unfortunately, that's what Aaron did, right? And you had the golden calf. So anyway, but starting from that time all the way until this time, Israel always, always, always had a problem following after other gods. Committing spiritual adultery is the theme of our thing goes. And stop being faithful to the one true God. Because as Jesus said, you can't love God and money, right? Or the things of the world. You can't love both at the same time, right? You can't do it. God tells Hosea, as he relates it, I want you to go and marry a harlot. I want you to go and marry a whore. And I want you to have children with her. Now, you must choose for a wife someone you know has been unfaithful and loose, as we would say. And you must marry that person even though you know that. And you must accept children, even maybe some of those children that she has may not be his own children. Or maybe when she marries him, she's never been faithful and probably never will be. He has to accept the fact that maybe some of the children she has when they're married may not be his children. Think about that. How many men in this audience would do that today? Like, I wouldn't marry a prostitute today. And I wouldn't want to marry someone who's going to cheat on me and have children by other men with me, right, as the husband. I would say, ain't signing up for that. And Hosea probably would have said the same thing, but the Lord told him to do it. The marriage of a prophet, a holy man, a prophet, to a prostitute, that really highlights, as it says at the end of the verse, the bleakness of the times in which Hosea was living. Hosea was going to be a living symbol, a symbol that you can see. He's going to be a living symbol of Israel during those times. And he is going to serve to be a message of condemnation also to Israel, as we'll see. Many times in the Bible, God calls on his people to do extraordinary things or make unusual sacrifices to get his message across. Think about this sacrifice that Hosea is going to have to do, right? Sometimes God asks those sacrifices of us too. But definitely I think God here asks a big sacrifice of Hosea. Verse number 3. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Dibleam, which conceived and bare him a son. So that is the prostitute, or that is the whore that he married, was Gomer, right? That's her name. And she conceived and bare him a son. And the Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel. For yet a little while I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. Verse 5. And shall come to pass that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Now his daughter's name literally means, by the way, verse number 4, call his name Jezreel. Jezreel literally means not pitied. not pitied. There's going to be no pity. This symbolizes the fact that God was changing his attitude towards Israel. He will feel no pity when they get punished. He will feel no pity when they go off into slavery. He will show no mercy, even to the point where he allows them to be taken away into their destruction. The southern kingdom of Judah still has a place in his affections, but the northern kingdom and the 10 tribes of Israel, that's it for them. He is, as if, as it were, not cutting them off, as he's cutting them off forever, like I will never, ever deal with you again, but he is as if he is turning his back on them, right? That's what's going to happen here. Look at verse number 8. The first verse number 4, Jezreel, that was a son. Let's look at verse number 6. And she conceived again and bare a daughter. And God said unto him, call her name Loroma, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but utterly take them away. That's the daughter that means not pity. Sorry, I got my kids mixed up there, right? And the idea that God's changing his attitude, he says right there, I will have no more mercy upon the house of Israel. Look at verse number 7. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. So Judah, he is still going to save, because Judah had not fallen completely off into idolatry and spiritual adultery, but Israel had, right? Verse number 8. Now he has another kid, a third kid. Now when she had weaned Loroma, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, call his name Lo-Ammi, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. Now that word, Lo-Ammi, literally means not my people. That's why God said to call him that, because ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. I can't think of any worse thing to hear for anybody than for God to say, you're not my people, and you're not my God, right? And I'm not your God, excuse me. I'm not going to be your God. Israel had drifted so far into idolatry that Lomai represented that gulf between God and Israel. They are not his, so he's not going to be theirs. They may as well be just another pagan country as far as God's concerned. I'm no longer your God, and you're no longer my people. Israel had drifted so far that this represented that gulf between God and Israel. Let's look at verse number 10. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered, and shall come to pass. Then the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there shall be said of them, ye are the sons of living God. Now this shows a little bit of hope for the future. Does it not? Shows a little bit of hope for the future. Verse number 11. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. So there will be a time amidst the gloom and the judgment. God provides some rays of future and a rays of hope. He said, yet the number, it says in verse 10, will be as sand. Did I read that right? Measured nor numbered. Children of the sea shall be as the sand of the sea, right? Can't even number them. Their names would change from you're not my people to ye are, at the very end of verse 10, the sons of the living God. Israel and Judah will be reunited. And as the 80s song said, and it feels so good, reunited. And so they will be reunited. Ray Ortland writes this. He says, the divorce announced in chapter 1 is truly in force, but only for Hosea's generation. Divine mercy is not defeated by human sin. Aren't you glad of that this morning? God's mercy is not defeated by your sin. If it were, we would have been outcast and gone a long time ago. If it were, we would have been like Jonah, except there would have been no whale to save us. We would have just drowned into the depths of the sea. But the good news is God's mercy is not defeated by human sin, and it's not going to be defeated here. And that's kind of the idea of verses 10 and 11, right? Because God purposes to win a people for himself by his sovereign grace, and that is the purpose of the Bible. God has a people that he is going to bring to himself, right? In the Old Testament, it was the children of Israel. Nowadays, God's going to bring all his children to himself, all the saved, all the born again are going to be. And so that's the whole theme of the whole Bible is reconciliation. God is going to reconcile a people to himself. And these days, God is working, and we're to help in the work in the ministry of reconciliation. But that's the theme of the whole Bible. I think Scroggie called it the unfolding drama of redemption. So William something Scroggie said, the name of his famous two or three volumes. I've got them. The whole Bible. He goes to the whole Bible and he names it the unfolding drama of redemption. It's a drama, and the main theme of the drama is redemption, to redeem a people to himself, right? And so the good news is in verse 10, 11, God also shows that here as well. Let's go to chapter 2, if you would. Let's look at the first few verses of chapter 2 and we'll get more to our theme of spiritual adultery. Because when I said two or three weeks ago, I said, we're going to have a series of Sunday school lessons. It's going to be on adultery. I heard somebody laugh. I said, not that y'all need that that lesson on physical adultery. And someone laughed. Yes. Oh, do we not have a bell? Oh, okay. Did the first one ring or the second one? If a bell rings in the forest, does it really ring? I no one knows, right? So I would just say, so are you telling me that if the bells were ringing, the bad bell would have rang by now? Okay, but it hasn't rang. So I just have to take your word for that. Okay, that's okay. No, it's all good. I'll finish. We can worry about harlots next week, says brother. Yes, thank you, Brother Benjamin. So anyway, I call him Ben. I'm not used to calling him Benjamin.
Whatever.
Well, anyway. Well, you don't want to know what. Okay. Anyway, when I announced the topic, the coming series of Sunday school lessons, and I said it was going to be on adultery, but it's not the physical kind. Y'all know all about that. Someone actually laughed. I'm like, are they laughing because they think people in here know all about that, like in a real way? Or no, I knew they didn't mean it by that, but I thought. And then I had to clarify, no, I mean spiritual adultery, because that's something, if you're a Christian this morning, you can't commit. I'm sorry, can I back that up? I said it wrong. All right, I get because I'm closing. If you're not a Christian this morning, you can't commit spiritual adultery, can you? You're not married to the Lord. So what you're committing is sin and rebellion, and you're shaking your fist at God. You're telling him, I don't need you. I don't want you. Even if you're religious and going to a Baptist church, you're still saying, I don't want you the way that you want me to want you, or I don't want to follow the rules the way you want them followed, or I don't want to give up this particular sin yet, or I don't want to give up that particular sin yet. But whatever the case may be, if you're not saved this morning, this Sunday school lessons, they're not really applicable to you, and I don't say it in a mean way, but you can't commit spiritual adultery because you're not married to the Lord. You're not a child of God, right? You're not a bride. You're not a member of the bridehood. Is that the word, bridehood? Okay, I don't think so. Is it? Oh, I made it. I couldn't make it a word. I like when George Bush made up that word strategery. I always liked that. I always thought, and I'm not making fun because I liked George Bush as president, but he said the word strategery, and I'm like, okay, there we go. We're talking about spiritual adultery. So the Sunday school lessons aimed at Christians. And the idea is just like Israel committed physical adultery by bowing down to idols, they also were committing adultery spiritually. And we as Christians can do the same. Let's stand and be dismissed with a word of prayer.